ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Anthony Burke here, host of By Design on ABC Radio National, a show about the clever ideas and human stories behind the spaces, systems, and objects shaping everyday life. Whether you're curious about architecture, interior design, fashion, or anything in between, we reveal why design matters in a rapidly changing world. By Design on ABC Listen.
What's so bad about the way we tax capital gains that Labor leader Bill Shorten lost two elections trying to change it? And now that it's back in office, Labor is weighing up trying again. Capital gains, profits made from buying and selling things such as houses, are taxed at only half the rate of other income, at only half the rate of wages. Supporters say the special treatment helps landlords. Opponents say it rewards high earners and helps push house prices and home ownership out of reach. The arguments will be tested in a Senate inquiry next week, and then, quite possibly, in the first public stoush between Treasurer Jim Chalmers and Angus Taylor as opposition leader. So it's important to get up to speed. Does it really matter that we tax capital gains at only half the rate of other income? And what does it do? Welcome to The Economy Stupid on ABC Radio National with me, Peter Martin, and two of the 75 Australians who've made submissions to that Senate inquiry. Brendan Coates, who's Housing and Economic Security Program Director at the Grattan Institute, and Cahal Leslie, who's Generation Z and has already worked at the Productivity Commission, the Australian Treasury, and the Organisation for Economic Cooperation and Development in Paris, and now works in the AI sector, not exactly an underachiever. Welcome, Cahal, and welcome back, Brendan.
Pleasure to meet you, Peter.
Thanks, Peter. I feel like we've won the lucky dip of all those that submitted to the inquiry.
Brendan, there's no such thing as a capital gains tax. We should get that clear. There's only tax, in the case of you and me, it's income tax, but there were rules introduced 25 years ago that meant that only half of each capital gain had income tax applied to it. Now, what was the thinking behind that decision back in 1999?
So you're right, Peter. Capital gains are just an increase in the value of an asset, like property or shares, reflecting the fact they're likely to generate more income in future. So, for example, BHP shares go up in value because their future profitability is increased. You know, before 1985, we didn't have a capital gains tax at all. In 1985, we introduced one. Back in the day, what would happen is the cost base for the asset, so what you paid to acquire the asset, would be indexed for inflation. That would make sure that you're not actually paying tax on, you know, inflation. So say you buy a house for 100 grand in 1980 and you sell it three decades later for $1 million. Yes, on paper, you've made $900,000, but quite a lot of that's actually just changes in the price level. It's not actually income per se, and so we made sure that you weren't taxed on that.
It's special treatment, right? Because I am taxed on inflation. When I get interest from the bank, most of that is, sometimes all of it, is just compensation for inflation, but I'm taxed on that as income. Capital gains weren't. How has that changed?
So what changed is in 1999, following the Ralph Review, the government changed, at the time, the Howard government changed the policy from basically taxing those real gains, those inflation-adjusted gains, to just a flat 50% discount.
Only half of each capital gain was taxed.
That's right. So whatever the gain was, you'd only be taxed on half of it as part of your personal income tax or as part of a trust. And what that meant really was to try to simplify the system. So there's no need to make these complex adjustments to the cost base for every asset, so reduce compliance costs. There was also the idea that by simplifying and arguably making the system more generous, so having a lower tax rate on capital gains, it would spur lots of investment in more productive or dynamic ventures.
That's what they actually said. The Ralph Review said that. It said people will invest in high-tech, high-growth companies. It wasn't what happened. They invested in houses. What was that argument, Cahal? Was it that if you tax capital gains lightly, you're rewarding people for taking risks?
One of the justifications that people put forward for taxing capital gains lightly, along with inflation, is that we want to encourage risk-taking. So we know that returns to investment are risky, and we want people to save and invest, particularly in investment that can support employment and innovation. Unfortunately, we've seen a lot of people put that money into particularly existing housing.
Cahal, one of the arguments made was that taxing capital gains lightly recognises the risk involved in setting up a high-tech company or something like that. Is investing in property, houses, risky? It's obviously more risky than me earning a wage, but is it risky?
So I think it's less risky. So when we look at the way that capital gains are generated in the housing sector, it typically occurs because of reasons that are occurring outside of the property. So if you think of increasing population growth, which would increase demand for scarce locations, if you change council rules and you upzone properties, that increases the value of the property. None of these things occur because of the actions of the owner. They could just sit there, do nothing, and still be able to reap the rewards of that.
And that's probably why people dived into it. There's an asymmetry too, is there, Cahal, in that you're able to deduct for tax purposes 100% of your costs of investing in houses, which aren't particularly risky, but then get taxed on only half of the profit that results from that investment.
Yes. So Australia has a system, because all of our incomes kind of pool together, we don't discriminate between these different forms of income. So many countries, if you make a loss on an investment, it's not deductible against your, particularly your labour income. So in Australia, we've got this kind of perverse rules in our tax system where you can deduct losses at 47 cents and then reap rewards of a, let's say, a capital gain on housing at 23.5 cents. Most other countries limit that either to you've made losses elsewhere in your housing investments or elsewhere in your savings. They wouldn't do it for your labour income.
Brendan, what was the result of that change? What happened to housing?
Well, I think just to really clarify the size of that generosity of that gain, if the typical, if someone bought a home in 1999, on average, house prices have risen about 6.5% each year. The key thing here is you also borrow. So if you borrow 80% of the purchase price, then, you know, the capital gains tax discount is supposed to be, you know, a proxy for inflation, giving you, not making sure you're not taxed on the inflationary gains. But if you're investing with leverage into a property where it's going up by 6% a year and you're borrowing 80% of the purchase price, your return is like 25%, 30% a year, and the inflation might be 3%. So the discount is way too low. And we saw that play out in the way that housing markets responded. So we saw a big increase in the number of property investors. So the share of taxpayers that reported or declared a rental income to the ATO went from about 15% in 2000 to 20% in the late 2010s. It's come down a little bit because of changes to bank lending rules have made investing in property and borrowing to do so a bit less attractive. It's also meant that house prices did rise faster than wages through that period, although I would probably say that the change in the discount itself, the taxation of housing, is not the biggest driver. But certainly house prices have risen on average from three, four times average incomes in 2001 in most cities to sort of five, six, seven times in a lot of states since then.
Was the bigger effect that the investors, the new wave of investors, the New South Wales Treasury says investors borrowed about as much as first home buyers back before the change, and now they borrow twice as much or three times as much in New South Wales. Was the wave of investors essentially elbowing out people who would have been first home owners? And it's happened for so long now, we've had this in place, that we can actually see the effect.
That's right. So if you're going to have more investors and they're renting those homes to people, then you will by definition have a lower rate of home ownership, because if there's no one for those homes to be rented to, you know, by definition, those people would otherwise probably be first home buyers themselves. So New South Wales Treasury estimated that if you halve the capital gains discount from 50% to 25%, so you're taxed on 75% of your capital gains, and you curb negative gearing so you could only offset those, you know, interest costs and other costs against your capital income rather than against wages and salaries, then you would boost the rate of home ownership by about 3 percentage points in the long term, which would basically unwind more or less all of the decline in home ownership we've seen in Australia over the recent decades.
66% of homes are now owned by someone in them, and it used to be 71%. From the Menzies time right through to this change, it would move us back toward that.
Yeah, all else equal, there might be other factors like the fact housing has become less affordable that would keep pushing home ownership down, but it would certainly unwind quite a lot of what we've seen so far.
Cahill.
And yeah, just something I might add on to that. If we compare how we sit compared to other OECD economies, we have the second highest level of investment property wealth in the OECD. The only other country that beats us is the very tiny Luxembourg. It's 2.5 times the OECD average. So I think like our Australian obsession with investment property, it is a very Australian phenomenon. And I think our tax system has contributed to a lot of that.
Where does that benefit go? That is to say, who gets most of the tax concession, Cahill?
Like most tax concessions, it is largely at the top end. So the top 10% of, I guess people by wealth, almost all of it would go to that cohort. It's also because of these benefits of negative gearing, it's very attractive for people on high incomes to, you know, use that investment strategy. So it benefits people who are older, wealthier, and typically have higher incomes.
Is it worsening the divide between generations in income and wealth? Between my generation and yours?
Yes, definitely. If you look at stats on the rates of home ownership, it's been falling like every 10 years by several points. I think our generation has... It's something ridiculous, like 20 or 30% each point. I don't have the figures in front of me, but it's much, much lower in terms of home ownership.
What would you do to wind the concession back, Brendan? There are all sorts of suggestions. Halving the concession, stripping it back to actual inflation like it used to be, allowing it for capital gains that aren't to do with housing, but closing off housing, allowing it for new housing, not for existing housing, ending the right to negatively gear against wage income, something you're suggesting. What would you do?
Well, I'd say it's, first of all, two things that are true. One is that we do want to have probably a lower rate of tax on savings than we do on wages. Most economists would agree with that proposition.
Why would you want unearned income to be taxed at a lower rate than what I'd call earned income?
So most tax economists would say you've already paid tax on that income when you earned it before you saved it, and then you're taxed on the return to that investment. And what we find is that there's a compounding effect over time. So because you have to give up some of that return each year as tax, the effective tax rate you applied to that asset, to those savings, rises over time. And to avoid that, you want to have a lower tax rate. It's like compound interest, but in reverse.
All right. Well, what would you do?
We would halve the discount. So we would reduce it from 50% to 25%. I think there's some debate about what the precise level should be, but clearly 50% is too high. And for the sake of simplicity, just keeping that simple discount in place makes a lot of sense to us at Grattan Institute.
What about existing investors, so-called investors? They're not investing, really. Most of them, the bulk of them, are just buying existing houses. But what about existing investors? Would you let them keep the existing arrangements, so-called grandfathering?
No, I think that's actually, whatever we do, this is the most important part of the reform, which is that you apply it to all investments. I think there's this fallacy when we talk about what a term called retrospectivity, which is that you're applying a different tax rate based on decisions that were made in the past. But, you know, we change the tax rate that applies to someone's savings all the time. Every time you change the personal income tax scales, you are changing the tax rate that applies to an asset, say BHP shares I might have bought 15 years ago.
No one complains that that's retrospective.
That's right. And so I think that's the most important thing. Otherwise, you're basically pulling up the drawbridge on an incredibly concessional treatment of tax treatment of savings for a couple of generations that will probably keep holding onto those assets for a long time, and it will worsen the intergenerational bargain in the long term.
What would you do, Cahal?
So I would just cut the discount for investment properties. So I think, and that's to reflect that the gains that come in housing, they accrue from land and they accrue for reasons other than the owner's actual efforts. I would keep the discount for other assets like shares at the level it is at the moment. I think it's broadly about right. If you look at international tables, it's roughly at like the middle. So it's about in line with what other economies are doing.
Hold those thoughts as we prepare to examine what the sort of changes you're both proposing would do. Would they, as was claimed the last time Labor proposed something like them, crash the housing market? We're discussing what might well be imminent changes to the way we tax capital gains here on The Economy Stupid on ABC Radio National with me, Peter Martin, and economists Brendan Coates and Cahal Leslie. Brendan, when Labor leader Bill Shorten put forward an idea like this in 2016, the then Prime Minister, Malcolm Turnbull, said it would take a wrecking ball to home prices.
What does the Labor Party want to do? It wants to give the property market a kick in the guts. It wants to send those prices lower. It's going to be a pretty hard slog, I would say, defending a policy that has got vote Labor and be poorer. That's what that'll be this. Vote Labor and see your house price go down.
Brendan, Malcolm Turnbull won that election, and leaving aside whether that statement has aged well, these days many Australians would welcome home prices going down, what does your economic modelling, the Grattan Institute's modelling, suggest that what the change you're proposing would do to property prices?
Well, first, the change that we propose, which would be halving the discount, would, once it's fully implemented, raise it about an extra $6.5 billion a year. So that's $6.5 billion a year that isn't flowing as concessions into the pockets of investors.
That's important. It's a lot of money.
So it's a lot of money, but it's actually not a lot of money when you consider that Australian housing is worth $12 trillion today. And so we estimate that that change would reduce house prices in the long term by less than 1%. Because
less than 1%?
That's right, because the value of those concessions is small.
Yeah. Was suggesting he was talking about a collapse in home prices. What other changes would it bring about? What would it do to home ownership?
It would have a bigger effect on home ownership because you would see fewer investors with the value of that concession showing up at auctions and bidding on those new homes.
And a good deal probably selling, actually, selling to first home owners.
Well, it depends if we grandfather it or not. I think that's a big part of that conversation. But we would expect that the rate of home ownership would increase. New South Wales Treasury did estimate this would boost home ownership, as we said before. It would have a modest effect on the supply of new housing. So when we use the Reserve Bank's housing market model, we get a number of basically 10,000 fewer homes would be built over the 5 years to 2030.
This is because some of the so-called property investors actually build new properties. Not most, it's somewhere between 10 and 20%. But there'd be less of that.
There'd be marginally less of that, although you could more than offset that effect because the capital gains tax discount is not a very efficient way of incentivizing new housing investment because most of it is used to finance the purchase of existing homes. If you used even $1 billion a year out of that $6.5 billion we estimate it would raise and put that into, say, social housing, you would probably have a bigger impact on boosting supply than the current capital gains tax discount does with that $6.5 billion revenue hit.
So Angus Taylor could get what he said he wanted on the 7:30 report this week, which is more Australians into homes and greater home supply. What would it do to rents?
Well, let's just say those 10,000 fewer homes over 5 years manifest and there's no offsetting effect from investing in social housing, then rents would fall by less than a dollar a week. So these are really small numbers. Over those 5 years, we should expect something like 1 million homes to be built. And so we get 10,000 fewer. We're a nation that has something like 11 million homes today. So it's a tiny change in the balance of demand and supply in the stock of housing, which is what matters for house prices and rents.
Cahal, why not go even further and apply the capital gains tax to owner-occupied homes, the kind that I and Brendan live in and you don't? We are 100% exempt from capital gains tax. Indeed, if I had an investment property, which I don't, I could sell it after this change and pack my proceeds into an even more expansive house with bigger gardens and so on. It would be completely capital gains tax free. It's probably a very good financial strategy. Would you tax capital gains, the capital gains made by ordinary Australians, or perhaps only those at the very top end, only extreme capital gains? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I think there's definitely an argument for this. So the family home is the most tax advantaged asset in the of all the different options that you can invest in. I see a particular problem with it in terms of how we're utilizing houses. So if you imagine a pensioner who's thinking about renting out a spare bedroom, the moment they do that, they lose some of that very generous, fully exempt home primary residence exemption.
They change their status.
That's
and,
right.
And so that would be, in fact, be scary. That just that thought, regardless of how the finances turned out, might be enough to dissuade them from renting out rooms.
Exactly. And we have, there's a lot of homes in very nice areas in the inner cities of, in the inner parts of our cities, which are mostly empty. They're empty nests. And I think if we had a better taxation system of the family home, we might be able to get, better use of those things.
How might it work applying capital gains tax to, heaven forbid, the homes owned by Brendan and me?
So one way that you could do it is you only make it for homes above a certain value. Another way that you could do it is if you make a capital gain, but then you buy another house after that, you can choose to defer it and defer it again every time you buy a house. And then once you, God forbid, pass away, you would have a deemed event at the end of your life where you pay the tax out of your estate. So that's one potential model, yeah.
Would you do it, Brendan? Would you tax capital gains, maybe only very large capital gains, made by the owners of ultra-high-value houses?
Look, I think there is a case for it, absolutely, particularly for large, for very large homes. If we're talking about homes in Sydney or Melbourne that are selling for $50, $100 million, like a lot of that looks like just tax planning as much as, you know, wanting to have the nicest home as someone who's very wealthy, and it's a much lower tax rate, zero, than we apply to anything else. I think the tricky thing about extending capital gains tax more broadly to own-occupied housing is whether there'd be a push to say, well, you should be able to offset, deduct your costs, you know, the interest costs.
Would be tax deductible. And it is in the US, right, where in fact they do this. They do apply capital gains tax to high-value homes.
And because if you're doing this properly, you would probably also want to tax the what's called the imputed rent. Economists call basically the fact that I don't have to pay rent to anyone for living in my house. It's the value I get from being able to live in my home rent-free.
Hang on. Every homeowner listening is getting very upset at the idea that they're getting something tax-free, which is renting from themselves. If you can explain that to me in 30 seconds, I'll be really pleased.
Well, if you think if you're a property investor, you get the capital gain and then you get the rental income. If you're investing in a home that you live in yourself, then yes, you get the capital gain and you're also getting that benefit of living in that home rent-free and you don't pay any tax on that.
As if you were paying rent to yourself and there's no tax on that income.
That's right. So the risk would be if you only make capital gains taxable on the family home and you allow deductibility of the interest costs, but you don't tax what's called the imputed rent, then, you know, the budget position could get worse. You may in fact make the concession for unoccupied housing more generous rather than less.
A quick question to each of you. As you read the political situation, and it's changing day by day. We have a new opposition leader who's already speaking about this. What do you think is practically likely, Carl?
I kind of have a feeling it's going to be one of our two. Well, I'd say there's three things that could happen. One, nothing, which I think there's a long track record of governments not doing a lot in the tax space. I could also see them going with Brennan's suggestion of just cutting the discount. And I could also see it just being limited to property, particularly, for existing properties.
And I assume you don't expect the capital gains tax to be applied to Brendan's home or mine?
Oh, no, I don't think so. I think that'd be very unpopular with politicians.
What do you see, Brendan?
Look, I see all three options are still very live, but the government, it seems, I've never seen the messaging this strong that they are open to it. And certainly since the economic reform roundtable last year, the consensus that came out of that is there is a problem, an intergenerational problem in taxation that we tax younger people too heavily. And so I could imagine a world where they take up one of the options we've discussed today and use that to lower income taxes for younger Australians.
We'll see. Brendan, Cahal, thank you. Before we go, as is traditional on this program, anything to look out for in the days and weeks ahead? Cahal.
Yeah, so later this month, there'll be Senate hearings into the operation of the CGT discount.
It's actually on Monday, I think, next week.
Ah, yes. I don't know if you've got an invitation for that, Brendan, but I haven't.
You can come along with me, Cahal.
Okay. On Monday. All right. I think that confirms I did not get an invitation. So
I tell you what, it'd be a good double act. You've had a preview of it here first. I have read your submission, Brendan. What should we look out for in the days and weeks ahead?
I think if you're trying to make housing more affordable, then building more is going to make a much bigger difference. And the biggest reforms there are what the Victorian government has done, where they've relaxed planning rules to allow substantially more housing. They are, in my mind, probably the largest economic reform a state government has done in the last two decades. And so if you want housing to be more affordable, probably pay more attention to state politics and a little bit less to national politics.
Brendan Coates and Cahal Leslie, a former Treasury and Productivity Commission economist, both of whom have made submissions to the Senate's inquiry into capital gains. Thank you both so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening. You can find our episodes on the ABC Listen app or live on ABC Radio National Thursdays. If you have any thoughts or questions or comments, no economic question is stupid, you can email us at theeconomy.stupid@abc.net.au. Listener Janice has done that. Janice writes, "Hi Peter, I love the show. Thank you so much for the community service you provide. Your guest mentioned the percentage of rent, said it hadn't increased over the last decade. Why then do I feel so pinched?" A very good question, Janice. If you look at the figures, in fact, include right up to today, the figures from the Bureau of Statistics on rents, the rents actually paid, they were falling. They fell during COVID. And a move from a fall to an increase is quite noticeable. In fact, in early 2022, they were no higher than they were in 2018. Now, since then, they've jumped 22%. But that's really over 7 years in total, and that's an annual increase of about 2.8%. But we notice changes, and it has been a big change. Thanks to producer Hayley Crane. I'm Peter Martin. We'll see you next week.
Listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.